Tomorrow, New Mexico Women in Film is sponsoring one of their monthly member events at both inform and connect the local film community. Tomorrow's event at Center Stage in Santa Fe is a forum about gender parity in the film industry. We'll be talking about more details about that event later on. Gender parity is a very hot issue. There's a lot happening around discrimination against women in Hollywood in both films and TV. And the featured speaker at tomorrow's forum and my first guest this afternoon has been a crusader and a strong activist, instrumental in making things move on these issues. And I'm really happy to welcome film director and screenwriter Maria Geese. She joins us by phone today. And I say hi to you, Marie. How are you?
Hi, Carol. I'm so glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm so glad that we got a good phone connection and that you can spend the time this afternoon with us. You know, there's an article in the L.A. Times that I read. Actually, it may be the Hollywood Reporter. I have read so many articles for this interview today, and it's been really fascinating, and I have learned so much, and that's why I've been chomping at the bit to talk to you. But anyway, they called you a troublemaker, and I do believe I know the answer to this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Is this a title that you relish, troublemaker?
It sure is. You know, we've often heard from many great women throughout history, not least of all, and most recently Nora Ephron, calling for women to be troublemakers for the advancement, especially of you know, other women. And so I'm very proud to have this name.
In fact, I had read that you have a contract with a literary agency, and they have contracted you to write a book called just that, Troublemaker. Is that right?
That sure is right, yeah. And so I've been working on that for the last 6 months and will continue to do so over the course of the next year. And it's really been a pretty extraordinary experience working on that, reflecting back on the last 5 years of activism.
Yes, I bet. And we're going to talk about some of that. But I want to start off having you talk a bit about how you, where that aspiration came from to be a film director as a young Maria, and you wound up going to film school. But why don't you talk about that a little bit? What were you, a teenager or younger when you decided that's what you wanted to do?
I was a teenager. I actually grew up in Puerto Rico in San Germán Cotuí in a barrio. We didn't have a television or a telephone, so until I was 10 years old and we moved back from the States. So I really didn't have any access to media, and what I loved the most was dreaming, and my dream world was very vivid. The world I grew up in was very beautiful, and mountains and rainforests and, you know, snorkeling and the reefs. And so it was just a very vivid childhood. And when I moved back to the States when I was 10 and first started seeing movies, I was just floored. And it was the closest thing during waking hours in conscious life that I thought you could get to dreaming. And I just wanted to make movies after
as opposed to being, let's say, the star of a film. You decided that you wanted to be the director?
Yeah, no, I never wanted to be a star. I definitely wanted to tell stories and get them on the screen. That was very clear. And then in the early 70s, I guess in the mid-70s, I saw Lena Wertmüller Swept Away.
Yeah.
The first time I ever saw a film that people told me was directed by a woman, and it was a huge inspiration to me. I loved the movie for one thing, but for another, it made me realize, boy, I can do this too, and I never veered away from that goal, from that dream again to this very day. except that I've had to put it on hold for a few years.
Right, and we're gonna talk about all that the reasons for you putting it on hold and what has happened in these several years. So you got accepted into UCLA, which is quite something.
Yes, I was really excited after I graduated from Wellesley College to be accepted into UCLA Graduate School into the directing program. It was very competitive, and I was not amazed. I wasn't surprised at all that my class was half men and half women.
Well, thanks to Title IX.
Thanks to Title IX, which has been very successful, yes, thank God.
And so you were a pretty successful student.
I had a fantastic 5 years at UCLA Graduate School. I was graduated at the top of my class and won many of the awards that you can win, even after just my first film, which won a Spotlight Award and a Cine Golden Eagle and was a finalist for a Student Academy Award. And then I made another film after that. So I had a really, really successful time. I was already signed by an agent in my second of 5 years of graduate film school and started writing professionally during the next 3 years.
And actually, you were handed your diploma, your Master of Fine Arts, by Francis Ford Coppola.
I was one of my favorite directors at the time. And so he looked at me and handed me my diploma and shook my hand and said, good luck.
But he didn't say it cynically, did he?
No, he did not. He really meant it.
Because that good luck, when you look at it soon thereafter, wow. So you did.
It
was irony, maybe.
It could have been irony.
Right. So you actually made a film. Was that in England?
Yeah, so right after I graduated and I got greenlit to direct a feature film called When Saturday Comes.
What does greenlit mean? Given the go-ahead?
Given the go-ahead, that's right. I actually had taken the project around to many, many different production companies in Hollywood and had no luck at all. And then we got, continuing in development, got Sean Bean attached and took it to production companies in the UK, and Capital Films took me on and took on the project. Capital Films was one of the top independent film companies in the UK at the time, and it was run by two women. And so that was my first feature, and that film starred Sean Bean and Pete Postlethwaite, Emily Lloyd, and I had an absolute first-class cast and crew from beginning to end. It was just a really, really extraordinary, wonderful experience.
So one would say, wow, her dreams are coming true. She's on the way to whatever, the big time. Succeeded in film school, produced a great film. It was screened at Cannes.
It was screened at Cannes in 1995.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah, and I got signed at the William Morris Agency in the UK, and also in Los Angeles, by a top agent, and who had Robert Duvall and Diane Lane and Billy Bob Thornton, very, very big clients, and so I was really pretty excited about what was going to come in the coming years.
Except 1995 turned out to be an interesting year because I read that was the year the number of female directors that were hired hit its all-time peak.
That's right.
And then it plunged?
It went into slow stasis and decline during the course of my whole career.
What was the climate that started happening after 1995 that created this situation?
Well, there are a lot of different theories about that. I think that the most important indicator was, why did the numbers start going up in the first place?
Uh-huh.
In 1979, there are six courageous women in the Directors Guild who hadn't been able to get work for years and years and years decided to find out what was going on, and they started counting the numbers, the number of deal memos that were going to women in that year. And they found that just 0.5% of the directing jobs were going to women. And so they took this information to a lawyer, and the lawyer said, well, you know, this is certainly an indication of rampant discrimination, of Title VII violations, and you can do one of two things. You can sue your guild, the Directors Guild of America, or you can sue the studios. And so these women took this information to the Directors Guild. Michael Franklin, this wonderful head of the Directors Guild at the time, listened to them, and he said, you know, well, he certainly didn't want to get sued by these women. And so he decided to get active and take this project on for them and with them. But after several years of making no headway whatsoever, he decided to sue. And so the Directors Guild filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of its women and ethnic minority director members. And that lawsuit resulted in 1985, Judge Pamela Reimer ruled, actually, that while the lawsuit was viable and important and should be continued, that the Directors Guild cannot lead the class because it constituted a conflict of interest that a guild run by a vast majority membership of men, white men, could not possibly fairly represent the concerns of women and ethnic minorities. So she disqualified the Directors Guild from leading the class, and thereupon the suit ended. However, that was 1985. Within 10 years, because of that legal action, the number of working women directors went from 0.5% to 16%. It literally skyrocketed. So 1995, it hit that number. That was the peak, and then it went down. So one can say, you know, well, what happened then? You know, this action that these women took came in the wake of the civil rights movement of the 1960s and the women's lib movement of the 1970s. There was a lot of, you know, enthusiasm for civil rights issues and women's issues. And I think by 1995, as the economy was booming, women kind of, including myself, you know, I have to say, I wasn't, hadn't done much in this area. I just anticipated that things were going to be better for me, be good for me, because they had, this skyrocket and skyrocketing of the numbers had happened in the previous years, and I didn't stop to think why that happened. I didn't stop to think that these extraordinary women put their careers on the line and took so many risks to make this happen for all other women, for women as a collective. That was a heroic gesture.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, in the next 10 years, we women kind of let the ball drop, including myself. So and then just inherent bias against women kind of took over, and so the numbers just went into decline and stasis. There is another reason, but I don't know how detailed you want me to get. You know, I think that the right after that lawsuit, the Directors Guild began to make agreements with the studios in collective bargaining negotiations, and they started up diversity programs to try to advance women and ethnic minorities. And two things happened. One is that kind of a system of cronyism developed, because, of course, the DGA should not be involved in Title VII. It was, as Judge Pamela Reimer correctly ruled, a conflict of interest for them. They are not impartial and objective. The members in the guild are actively competing for open assignment jobs. And so for them to have this diversity program, it would be very easy for just a few of the director members, women and of color, to use it for their own advancement. And I think that's exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm.
A corrupt system evolved out
right.
of that with no oversight. And in the meantime, the organization that should be overseeing Title VII, which is the EEOC, just was leaving it in the hands of the Directors Guild. So things sort of fell apart for women directors in a much more extreme way than would have happened otherwise, and that happened in any other industry. You know, today,
right.
Hollywood is the worst violator of Title VII, where women are concerned, of any industry in the United States.
You know, that was one of the things that I was shocked from doing my reading before our conversation today, that if you look at other heavily male-dominated industries, which is like tech, and finance and science and engineering and the military, They have a better percentage, a higher percentage of women who are in, you know, these higher positions than the film industry.
Yep.
And that's
right.
Absolutely amazing.
It is. It's really shocking that liberal Democrat Hollywood discriminates so horribly against women. And it really is kind of a devastating blow to women in our country and girls in our country and people everywhere in the world, because the stories and the films and TV shows that we create in Hollywood really do form, they define our national ethos to a certain extent, perhaps to a large extent, and they really do form the voice of our civilization to a large extent.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this voice is coming almost 100% from men.
Yeah, men are being the storytellers, and women's voices essentially are being silenced.
And even when a woman does get to tell a story, she has to go through the voice piece of this male patriarchy in Hollywood. So It really can't be said to be fully authentic. It's essential. It's so imperative that this be changed. You know, all these other countries, Sweden, Norway, Ireland, England, Canada, Croatia, Australia, New Zealand, did I say? These countries, because of, in large part, the letter that the EEOC wrote and was published in the New York Times in 2015, these countries are making these sweeping initiatives for 50-50 gender hiring mandates among directors in their film and in their entertainment industries. But Hollywood is doing nothing. The United States entertainment industry is doing nothing.
We're going to get to that letter in a little bit. Let me tell listeners, if you just tuned in, this is Women's Focus. My name is Carol Boss, and my guest today is Maria Giese, G-I-E-S-E. She has been a screenwriter and a film director and has been an activist for many, many years. So essentially, you couldn't find work, and when did it get to the point when you said, I'm doing something about this?
Yeah. Well, let's see. So I was working steadily on development of projects from 1995 until 2010, and I was attached to direct and do rewrites on a handful of feature films. Two of those went into production, but at the 11th hour, they pulled them from me and gave them to male Canadian directors. Every time you get a film greenlit, it usually constitutes many, many years of full-time work that you don't get paid for. And so I was finding that I was busy all the time developing projects and trying to get things off the ground and writing screenplays and so forth and so on, but it was always ending up with no job. It was almost as if people were happy to have me working as long as I wasn't getting paid. And I noticed also that all my female colleagues, my classmates, my friends who had also made a feature film perhaps, or you know, had been trying, none of us were getting anywhere. And so around 2011, I just had had it. You know, I couldn't find work. I was so frustrated.
That's a long period of time from when your film was produced, what, 1995 to 2011. Wow.
Yeah, so that was about, what, 15 or 16 years of working all the time. And, you know, you have to be pretty, you know, optimistic and a very determined person to prevail in Hollywood or even to just keep going in Hollywood.
So you were able to self-fund yourself?
I am those things, you know. I was always hopeful that something was going to happen. And there were always new things to work on. But... The lack of income really became very, very just a terrible strain and draining on me. And I felt really, really angry. You know, I felt that I had a lot to offer and I had, you know, these successes. I had shown that I had demonstrated that I could do the job. I also had been observing on Dick Wolf TV shows for hundreds and hundreds of hours on Crime and Punishment and L.A. Law and Law and Order, and then they would never give me an episode, but they were giving all these guys episodes who didn't have anywhere near my experience. Mm-hmm. And so that was a big frustration for me, too, because when you're a feature director, getting TV work is really can be the bread and butter of your life. It can keep you going. And so it was just really frustrating.
Can I quote a few statistics?
Yes, please.
I was reading how there was a study that showed, for example, that 90% of American broadcast television programs employed no women directors during the 2000 through 2012 television season. And there's lots of programs require directors, so there was not one. Oh. And one point...
1.9%.
Yeah, you know which
100 feature films.
The top grossing films
were directed by women. That means you know almost 100%. That means you know 98% of 98.1% of these feature films are going to men, and you know that really is tantamount to censorship. I mean, that really shows that women are shut out. We're excluded.
And even in commercials, which is pretty lucrative, women direct just 1%. And so you know what the other percent is, that 99% that we've heard about for so many years.
Well, and guess what? The commercial category, the commercial sector of our industry is the directing category that's the most lucrative. And so you really do see that where there is more money, women are more completely excluded.
And that includes commercials for tampons, for lingerie. They're all almost exclusively directed by men. And,
oh, my God.
And the one other thing that I wanted to say was that just as a reminder to listeners, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, that's Title VII, that's the law that spells out our constitutional right to equal employment opportunity. So let's...
That law was fought and won in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
We don't need to fight that battle anymore.
That's right.
We fought it and we won, but our country... has our industries in our country and Hollywood has an obligation to obey that law, and our federal government, the EEOC, has an obligation to enforce that law. So where we see it so profoundly violated in such an important industry, it is imperative that this be ended.
So Maria Geis became fearless.
I still am.
She became and still is, yes.
I became fearless. To be honest, I really did. Because one of the things that keeps women in line in Hollywood is fear that you're not going to get a job, that you're going to get blacklisted. And it's not just women, it's everybody. There's a lot of nepotism, cronyism, in Hollywood, of course. It's a small, personal industry. People know each other. Word gets around fast. There are power centers like the Directors Guild or agencies where and lists that people keep. So it's very easy for people to, you know, don't hire that person. And I guess I got to the point in 2011 where I was pretty sure I wasn't going to ever work again. And so I thought, well, you know something, if I'm not going to work again, then I'm going to change things for all women. I don't care if they shoot me or run me off the road. I'm going to fix this problem. The buck stops here with me right now. And at that point, I had a little girl, 5 years old. I did not want to see her grow up in a world where she could not dream of being a director or a storyteller in this country. And the truth is that if even today, these years later, if you cannot tell a young girl, a teenage girl, a college girl, that she can dream of being a director. If you do say that, you will be lying. When you look at the number of women directing feature films, studio features, that's about 4%. Okay, so 4% of feature films, studio features, are directed by women. Okay, but who is that 4%? That 4% is comprised almost 100% by movie stars and pop stars and centimillionaires, relatives of movie moguls. I mean, from Madonna and Barbara Streisand and Angelina Jolie, even Sofia Coppola and Catherine Bigelow, associated with James Cameron and Francis Ford Coppola. Mm-hmm. It really shows that any woman who wants to join the boys' club as an auteur director, you know, to be, directing feature films at a higher level, studio features, you really have to be rich enough and powerful enough to command the executives to be able to finance it yourself if you want. And so where does that leave American girls? Where does that leave American women who have given their lives, like I did, to pursue this career, to have a voice, to tell stories, to be a part of this, you know, extraordinary, you know, cultural form of storytelling? That leaves us nowhere. That leaves us silenced. It leaves us censored. It leaves us leaves us completely marginalized and on the outside, and that is most certainly not right.
So then began what was probably not classified by you as glamorous work. What was the first thing that you did? You started doing a lot of research. I know that.
Yeah, it was not glamorous, I can tell you that. So the first thing I did was I started doing a lot of research. And then I went into my Directors Guild, to the Women's Steering Committee, that had been established in 1979 by the original six, those six women I spoke about a few minutes ago, who had made such an extraordinary contribution to female voices in Hollywood. I went into that committee and I started asking questions and I started saying, well, what's going on here? And I very, very, very quickly discovered that the Guild did not want any part of this. They did not want women speaking out. They did not want the issue of women directors brought to the forefront. They were happy to glorify the exceptional woman who got a feature film off the ground, or, you know, even, you know, Catherine Bigelow, who won an Academy Award, rightly so. She's so wonderful and gifted. They were happy when an exceptional thing happened to throw a little attention on it, but they were not interested in shifting the ratio of female-to-male employment amongst their members.
Is that including the Women's Steering Committee that you're talking about as being part of the Guild?
Shockingly, it did. And the reason was that the women who were the co-chairs, who were in the leadership positions on the committee, were getting a little bit of TV directing work. And so they were part of this very small pool, employment pool in episodic television that had remained static for all these years. And it seemed to me that the Guild had a very powerful interest in making it remain static. And of course, if it didn't remain static, if that slice of the pie that was going to women was going to expand, that was going to necessarily take jobs away from male DGA members. So that, and the Guild, of course, is run by their director members, so they did not want that to happen. But worse, the Women's Steering Committee is part of a greater diversity program in the Guild, and that program had unfortunately come to be manipulated by a very few people, particularly by Paris Barclay, who is our current president of the Directors Guild, and really rose to power through the diversity program. And he established in 2004, through the then president, Michael Apted, a diversity task force, and he was the head of that diversity task force all the way from 2004 until I made all the fuss. I did all my troublemaking. So you can imagine, you know, a diversity task force in the Directors Guild of America is this little committee, this force, was charged with interfacing with executives at the studios and saying, look, you've got to hire more women and ethnic minorities. Well, the temptation is obviously much too great. You know, you have to be, a saint not to, if you're a director in this incredibly competitive field, you're going to put yourself first. You know, obviously, you know, Paris Barclay wanted to get jobs too. And so, of course, guess what? You know, he got a ton of work, and women, the number of women remained in total stasis.
You know, when I read about him, I wanted to hiss and boo. He was like the bad guy for me.
He's a bad guy. He's a bad guy for women. He really, really has done no favors. I do truly hope that his Machiavellian approaches to his own personal advancement do, you know, get some light shined on them as the years go forward, because, you know, it looks like that's just hurting a few women in the Guild, but it's hurting all women in America, and it's hurting all people in the world that we're not able to get to be a part of the storytelling process because some avaricious people in the Directors Guild, you know, are keeping the doors shut tight, are keeping the pool small. And this is criminal, in my opinion.
It's legally awful, and it's a moral issue, too. And you decided to, obviously smartly so, to delve into the legal issues. And you started doing research, right?
Well, I did. So I headed down. I found out, thanks to Janet Davidson, who is the person who invited me to participate in the interview, in the conversation tomorrow at Women in Film, I found out about the original six, who weren't even called the original six at the time. I coined that term for them. They were buried in history. But I found out about them, and so I didn't know how to get hold of them. Instead, I headed down to the L.A. courthouse downtown and started combing through all of the documents and figuring out what happened with that lawsuit and why didn't it work and who else was doing stuff. And suddenly it occurred to me that we have a fantastic opportunity here for another class action lawsuit. And so why don't we do it? At the time, another group of women I was now joined with this fantastic, strong group of small, little handful group of women in the Women's Steering Committee, and we began to produce a summit in 2013, March 2nd, 2013. We held the summit at the Directors Guild of America. Even after having faced incredible hostility from them, they didn't want to have the event. And in fact, just anecdotally, one of the things we did on that day, and this was the biggest this is the biggest summit, the biggest event for women directors that had ever happened in Hollywood history, that had ever happened in Guild history. One of our real concerns had been going into it that we really didn't have an existing community of women. So what we wanted to do was gather all of the names and contact information of the women, who were almost 200 of them, who attended this event. And so we had everybody write their names and phone numbers and emails on sheets of paper. And at a certain point, the head of diversity at the Directors Guild, Regina Render, asked to have those that she wanted to photocopy them. She would give them right back. So reluctantly, several of the women who were running the summit handed them to her. She took them upstairs, and they would never give them back.
Oh, wow.
To this day, they have never given them back. They did not want us to create a unified community of women directors, and that is pretty telling. So we had this really incredible event, and at the event we played around with the idea of you know, lawsuits, of legal action. You know, what is going to make a difference here? Now, I forgot to mention that before the summit, the month before the summit, on Valentine's Day 2013, I actually had gone to the EEOC. I had made the an appointment with them, you know, I don't know, at least a month before.
So let's just say for those...
I had a four-hour interview with these agents.
Let me just say what that is for those who are not familiar. That's the EEOC is the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, federal.
Yes, that's part of the Department of the Department of Justice that enforces Title VII and Equal Employment Opportunity. So they knew all those guys. They were old guys mostly in that meeting, and they knew about the all the stuff that had gone on in the 70s and so forth. Their biggest concern was that they felt that they couldn't take on a class action case. They couldn't do something industry-wide, and that really all they could do was take on individual discrimination cases. And for that to be viable, the act of discrimination would have had to happened in the last 12 months. As I explained to them, any woman director who's in the current, who's worked in, you know, recently, in the last 12 months, in any case, is certainly not, she's in the current. She's hoping to get work. She is not going to put her career on the line, risk everything to sue somebody in this industry. That wasn't going to happen. And so the only other way to do it was class action. And I had come up with a legal strategy that had bounced off some very brilliant lawyers, and we thought that it could really work. And unfortunately, even though I think that they saw that it was viable, because of the 2011 Walmart case, in which the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Walmart, 1,500,000 female Walmart employees sued Walmart for wage discrimination. And so in 2011, the Supreme Court ruled against them in favor of Walmart. And that set the precedent that you can't use statistical evidence as the primary form of evidence in a class action discrimination case. So this was a terrible blow to civil rights groups who were interested in using statistical evidence to prove discrimination, because very often that is the only thing you've got. And in fact, for us women in directors in Hollywood, that is the best and most important and most telling piece of information, and we shouldn't really need more than that. But anyway, that was another reason that everybody advised me it was going to be very hard to get a class action case going. And in fact, later after the summit, when I went to the ACLU, who are just an awesome organization.
Well, that was a brilliant thing to do.
Yeah, and it was the watchdogs of civil rights in the United States of America, and it's a publicly funded organization. So it's not sort of, you know, this old, big lumbering behemoth organization like the EEOC. It's a very lean organization of innovative, bright people who can act with alacrity, who can move quickly on things, and they do. They can. They save lives. You know, shortly before that life might be lost. I mean, they are able to get things into gear and act very quickly, and that doesn't really happen with big government organizations like the EEOC. Still, they were, I think, a little reluctant. I think that the 2011 Walmart case played into that. But they were so cognizant. It was so obvious to them what the problem was. I gave them all my material, my research, introduced them to this core group of women and explained the overall theory and why this is, you know, an issue of such great importance nationally, globally, and so they took it on. They took the campaign on, and it was just, you know, amazing, because if they hadn't done that, I think that would have been probably the end of the road for me. I don't think I probably could have gone much further with my activism.
Maria, we have a few minutes left. Let me tell folks, this is Women's Focus. If you just tuned in, my name is Carol Boss, and Maria Geis is with us. And she has been a Hollywood director and screenwriter, and she has been an amazing activist to actually, I don't like using fight words and battle words, but that's what it has been, a battle against discrimination of women in film and TV. And by the way, we have a two-week archive. If you've missed a lot of this interview, or you want to hear it again, or you have someone else who you think might be interested, you can go to kunm.org and go to our two-week archive. It'll be up for another 2 weeks. So you went to ACLU, and they wrote, let's see, they wrote a letter to EEOC, right?
Yeah, so Melissa Goodman and Ariella McDowell, two lawyers at the ACLU, wrote what is going to go down in history as a historic document, and they called for the EEOC and two other agencies to investigate discrimination against women directors in Hollywood. And that was really, really rocked the industry, and it resonated all around the world. So it has been, it's momentous. And about 6 months later, let's see, that was April 12th. Oh, well, let me just add, you know, so April 12th, that letter came out. And then May, mm-hmm. May 12th in 2015, that letter was published in the New York Times. And the next day was the annual meeting for the Directors Guild of America. So that's the biggest meeting of the year. And Paris Barclay, the president, was running the meeting. In the whole course of the meeting, he did not mention, nor did anyone mention, this extraordinary document that had been published in the New York Times that was directly about the need for the advancement, the need to rectify discrimination against their own women members.
And obviously,
Their raison d'etre, mm-hmm. in the world, the Directors Guild's reason for being is to protect the creative and economic rights of their members. That means women too, women directors.
Totally ignoring the biggest news in Hollywood,
yeah,
obviously, at that point.
They were hostile to it. And the reason they were hostile to this letter was because the ACLU had pointed a finger of complicity at them. They said that the DGA was also part of the problem.
And then after that letter from the ACLU to the EEOC, EEOC jumped on board.
So then it was pretty amazing. I think it was October 2nd of that year. What's that, 6 months later? I was one of the first women to get a letter, an email from the EEOC asking us to interview with them, and that meant that the investigation was on.
Amazing day.
So
gender justice, right?
Yeah, I broke that news to the LA Times. And then, of course, May 12th, exactly 1 year later, the ACLU spoke to the LA Times again. So that was, 7 months after the EEOC investigation actually begun. The ACLU spoke to the LA Times and let them know, because the EEOC can't communicate. They are they function confidentially. Their investigation is confidential. It's a one-way door. It's a door going in, not coming out. So you can't get information about what's going on with the investigation, except what information they want to let out. So the news came out that after 6 or 7 months of investigating and interviewing women directors, they were now ramping up the investigation and moving it into the industry at large. And that means that they can ask to interview anyone in the industry, agency heads, executives, studio executives, people, anybody at all. They want guild people, anybody they want. And if those people don't want to talk, they can subpoena them. And so that's what's going on right now with that. I've moved on to a new kind of approach to continue my activism, which is try to take this whole issue. It already is taken out. You know, this issue is now with the EEOC and the federal government, but what I'd like to do is start to get a lot of people unified around the concept that in order for effective, enduring, real change to happen for women directors, that we have to make amendments and to update Title VII so that it is enforceable in Hollywood. And that means there has to be legal action, there has to be a lawsuit, it has to go to the Supreme Court, and we can all put our heads together and figure out a way to make these amendments. You know, Title IX didn't work, hasn't been so effective just for no reason at all, because it was so beautifully written in the first place. It's undergone myriad amendments and updates, and not so for Title VII. So I think, you know, now is the time for us to take this challenge on.
Maria, this would make an amazing film. We've got.
Can I direct it?
You can direct it. They're the bad guys.
They're bad guys.
There are heroines, and you're one of them. I'm using heroine instead of hero because I want to definitely put that in the feminine. And so one day, and it's going to be a book, and maybe that'll become a major motion picture.
Wouldn't that be great?
Starring and directing. She doesn't want to star, but Maria Geis. And Maria Geis is going to be speaking. It's going to be by Skype, but, you know, lots of good things are happening via Skype. And New Mexico Women in Film tomorrow is presenting a forum on gender parity in the film industry. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And it's at Center Stage Santa Fe, 505 Camino de los Marques in Santa Fe. If you're not a member, you will have to purchase a ticket. And I think it may be too late to do any calls. I don't have any phone numbers for that, but you might want to show up if you want to at least see Maria on Skype and hear her talk on this forum. And I am so glad to have the opportunity to talk to you. And this is an amazing history. It's historic. And hopefully some good things are starting to happen in the film industry. I don't think we have time to talk about that now. But I don't know, maybe one day. When is the book coming out? Is it still a couple of years away? I don't even know if you wrote it yet.
So I'm working on it. And you know, as soon as possible. But certainly, you know, probably, you know, not in 2017, but hopefully shortly thereafter.
Well, when you're ready to publicize a book, if we can have a conversation, that would be really wonderful.
Oh, Carol, I would love that. It's been a real delight to talk to you.
Okay, good to talk to you. Thank you so much, Maria Geis.
Thank you.